get a good job with more pay and you're okay. Money, it's a gas. Grab that cash with both hands and make a stash.
Advise that discussions on this show should not be construed as specific in recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, KVMR. The station and staff members are underwriters. And welcome to the 229th edition of Money Matters, entitled The Fed Marches On. Money Matters is about money, as money does matter, and matters of money affect us all in some way or another. Whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it, it controls our economy, our country, our planet, and in some way or another controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money, your lack of it, or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, Money Matters is about you. How is everybody? Well, again, I don't have to come on the air and say the Dow is plummeting. Dow's up 178. 17,503. Feds came out yesterday and said they weren't going to raise interest rates. So they backed off, saying they were going to raise rates four times in the year. And they raised rates once in December, which may or may not have caused the market sell-off. And it was a global, worldwide sell-off. And many analysts, including this one, doubted that they would be able to continue with their rate increases. And yesterday, they did not. They also revised their GDP growth from 2.4 to 2.2%. It's about the 19th revision they have made in the downward direction. You have to wonder about how accurate they are when they keep revising things. And when they say they're going to raise rates and then they don't. No doubt the stock market weighed upon them. The January sell-off, worldwide sell-off, and a little bit into February. So, can we believe what the Federal Reserve says? It's hard to say, and also looking at their track record, of how well they forecast the economy, and indeed how they're going to raise interest rates at a specific rate, is subject. Do we believe them yet? It's really hard to take them for their word, isn't it? Yeah, really is. So the markets bounced off their 15,003 Dow level and been kind of nothing but up the last couple of weeks. And yesterday's conclusion that they weren't going to raise rates may have something to do with the Dow rising again. So there you go. So what's in the news? We'll keep an eye on the markets today for you. Thursday is when the show is airing live, but you may be hearing a recorded version of it on another day. And, of course, you're welcome for that. My name is Mark Cunaberti. And I am your host for the next 45 minutes or so. Well, Aubrey McClendon. He was the co-founder of Chesapeake Energy. He had ridden more wild ups and downs in the energy patch than just about everyone. But on March 1st, as the world closed in on McClendon, he may have had something else on his mind. He was emailing people about a riverfront development in the hometown of Oklahoma City, the place where he had gambled for so much and for so long. Those receiving and talking to him said the 56-year-old sounded upbeat, optimistic. In short, he sounded like himself. 24 hours, McClendon was dead. What happened, we really don't know. On the morning of March 2nd, hours after being accused of rigging bids for oil and gas drilling rights, McClendon slipped away from his security team, climbed into his Chevy Tahoe, and drove his SUV into a concrete wall at high speed. The news reverberated through Oklahoma City like a thunderclap. Was it suicide? He sounded upbeat. Emails sounded normal. But the emergency people on the scene said he would have plenty of time to avoid the wall. This then, tragic end to his life, may seem to epitomize America's shale boom and its bust. Weeks on, many are struggling to make sense of it all. The circumstances surrounding McClendon's death, remember he was the co-founder of Chesapeake Energy. Details surrounding his death are now coming into focus. Police in Oklahoma City, they have yet to determine if the crash, which involved no other vehicle, was intentional. Emails he sent to business associates hour before held no clues, no hints of trouble. It is hard for us to comprehend that he is gone. An executive at American Energy Partners Limited, the venture McClendon founded after Chesapeake ousted him as CEO, told people in a gathering at Crossings Community Church in Oklahoma City. It seemed that McClendon was hatching plans for new business ventures right up until the end. His rise and fall was the stuff of legend. McClendon grew to become a towering figure by building Chesapeake Energy into a $37.5 billion company, thanks to his championing of controversial hydraulic fracking. But the very gas boom he helped create caused prices to plummet, clipping the company's value by more than half and triggering a shareholder revolt that led to his ouster as head of the company. He then formed American Energy Partners and raised more than $10 billion to amass drilling rights at various areas from America to Australia to Argentina. But that business, too, would soon buckle under the weight of collapsing energy prices. What happened to McClendon still remains a mystery. He had visited a restaurant venture in the same shopping center called Swanky Coach House. He had a lot of energy, and he was excited about what he was going to do. But he was perhaps despondent, being accused of charges of impropriety. And hours before an indictment, McClendon was still firing off emails. It's hard to say what happened to him. In his final email exchange with a compadre, the subject that he sent in his email was mundane, trying to find a date for the next foundation board meeting. Around 5:30 that day, a federal grand jury in downtown Oklahoma handed up an indictment. And he said, quote, "I've been singled out as the only person in the oil and gas industry in over 110 years since the Sherman Act became law to be accused of this crime in relation to joint bidding on a leasehold. I will fight to prove my innocence and clear my name." And Around 8 a.m. the next morning, the morning of his death, a business associate received an email from McClendon. The two had bumped into each other the evening before at an Oklahoma City restaurant where McClendon was dining with his daughter. He seemed normal, the person later told. The email was a little bit more than good to see you last night. Not long after that, McClendon sent that message. He climbed to his SUV and drove off. As he cruised along a two-lane country highway, he picked up speed, traveling well above the posted 50-mile-an-hour speed limit. With thick, bushy trees on both sides of the road, McClendon had limited maneuvering room. His car collided with a concrete wall, supporting a highway overpass at 9:12, according to the police report. Details of the crash have police investigators scratching their heads. The front end of his car hit the overpass support head-on. They have yet to determine whether it was an accident or suicide. He pretty much, said police officer Paco Belderrama, drove straight into the wall. There seemed to be plenty of opportunity for him to correct and get back on the roadway, and that didn't occur. What happened? We don't know. So, yeah, market seems to be semi-normal. And, I guess the question arises, what will become of the market? Oh, what's
going on? We had the bank.
All right. That was Alan Greenspan. And he's not the most exciting speaker. He was the former head of the Federal Reserve, of course. And we've talked about quantitative easing quite a bit on the show. It refers to the government's ability to create currency with the touch of a keystroke, and we've commonly referred to as money printing. I was going to call the show, if not Money Matters, Money Printing, because it has a lot to do with what this show has to do with. The ability to create money for free by the Federal Reserve, while the rest of us have to work for it, is deemed necessary in orders for the powers that be, the Federal Reserve, to, quote, control the economy. That the economy can be controlled by a central body is hotly debated, but the issue of money creation brings into play many market dynamics that we spoke about on the show before. Monetary money printing programs causes the quantity of dollars in an economy to increase. If you print more, there's more dollars. Much like a bumper crop of bananas, if you increase the quantity of bananas, that causes the price of bananas to fall. The same goes for dollars. Increase the quantity of dollars and the price of each dollar falls. But when the dollar falls, what does that mean? It means that it loses a little bit of purchasing power, and we know that as inflation. This inflation, however, is currency specific. And it means that more U.S. dollars causes the price of something to go up only if it's priced in U.S. dollars. But what happens to the price of a good when measured in other currencies? Since currencies can be arbitrarily created by willing governments everywhere, the measuring stick for the value of each currency is essentially other currencies. They are, for the most part, measured against each other. So when the U.S. dollar goes down in value, for instance, the Swiss franc might go up. A product using U.S. dollars may rise in price, while the same product purchased in Swiss francs may fall. See how that works? This inverse relationship of currencies has a unique effect when it comes to exports, what we sell to foreigners, and imports, what we buy from foreigners. If the U.S. prints more dollars and therefore causes inflation here, because the dollar loses purchasing power if you print more of them, our currency is said to get weaker, making our imports more expensive. But conversely, it makes our exports, what we sell to others, cheaper to foreigners. By printing more dollars, our corporations make more money because they sell more overseas, because their products are now cheaper in another currency. But it also causes you and I here to pay more for everything we buy. So for you conspiracy buffs out there, if the government was for the corporations, by the corporations, and of the corporations, a money printing propensity by a government would seem to confirm those suspicions. By printing more dollars, our corporations do sell more, But since this inverse relationship works against a foreigner's currency as well, their goods get more expensive, causing foreign corporations to sell less to us. These foreign corporations may then go to their governments and demand they print more of their currency as well to keep up with our printing. That, in turn, weakens their currency, so their goods get cheaper here. And a grand tit-for-tat encompasses monetary policies everywhere. If you print more, because your corporations will sell more and mine will sell less, I'll print more, so my corporations will sell more and yours will sell less, because the price of each good in what particular country will go up and down in relation to that country's printing. It all adds up to a great monetary printing race, commonly referred to as currency wars. And the U.S., being the leader, as it is the largest consumer of goods in the world, and therefore the largest spender of U.S. dollars, is the leader in money printing and exporting inflation. I say that because, in essence, when the U.S. embarks on massive money printing to fund itself, it forces the rest of the world to print and do the same. In a grand race to devalue each other's currency against the other, so everyone's corporations sell more, it goes back and forth, and the net effect can possibly be no value. However, the populace of each nation is doomed to higher prices caused by all those created dollars. In conclusion, it could be said that the U.S. is the biggest importer of goods in the world. That is true. But it is also the biggest exporter of not only goods, but the biggest exporter of U.S. dollars. Therefore, the U.S. could be said to be exporting its inflation. Because if it prints more money, it causes inflation, so it exports its inflation, our inflation, through money printing programs like quantitative easing, which, by the way, since 2008, have taken on a massive scale. We'll be right back to talk about deflation and inflation and rising prices in just a second. And you're tuned to your community radio station, Money Matters. My name is Mark Cunaberti, show 229. Many hours dating many years that the show has been on the air. Thank you for your support over the years. Is deflation back in business? What is deflation? Deflation is the opposite of inflation, where prices increase. Deflation, therefore, is when prices decrease. Now, we're familiar with inflation, but deflation is decreasing prices. One would think decreasing prices or deflation would be a good thing. And many an analyst agrees, using the logic that lower prices is good for the consumer. However, there are two sides to every story. One version of economic theory, which is the one used by central banks, Federal Reserve, is that deflation, falling prices, makes consumers hold off purchases because you wait for lower prices somewhere in the future. That delay in purchasing feeds off itself, where purchases are held off by consumers waiting for lower prices, which causes a lack of demand, causes a slack in demand because you're waiting for prices to fall. This lack of demand will cause producers to drop prices further so they sell more, and consumers again will wait. The result, it is thought, is a vicious circle of falling prices and slack demand as consumers continually delay purchases in hope of lower prices later. There are opponents to this theory. I am one. And we can look at history as a guide to support that view. When consumer prices fall, consumers can buy more stuff, right? And you can only hold off buying something so long, and then you're going to have to buy it even if you think prices are going to fall. I do agree, and many analysts agree, a falling price environment will cause an initial delay in purchasing. In other words, if you knew that cars were going to go on sale next month, you would not buy this month because of lower prices later. But because prices cannot continually drop, normal buying patterns will emerge, because the more you lower a price of something, the more demand you get, not less. That's basic economics. Lower the price and you sell more. We can only look at the price of handheld calculators back in the 80s. The first HP handhelds were over $800 a piece, yet people that needed them bought them. As the prices fell, consumers did not hold off buying calculators. On the contrary, the lower prices of these calculators brought more buyers into the market because more people could afford them. Handheld calculators sold like hotcakes as their prices went lower and lower. You increased your customer base with lower and lower prices. There is a problem with deflation, though. In a debt-ridden society, a society that has a lot of debt, deflation does wreak havoc on debtors, people who owe money, as what you owe doesn't decrease with prices. What you owe remains the same. You have a contract saying you're going to pay $100,000 on a house. Even though prices and wages may be falling, you still owe $100,000, and you're going to be hurt because your wages will fall as prices fall, but what you owe always stays the same. Central bankers believe that lower prices and a fall in wages will stagnate the economy. Lower wages will make it harder for people to pay off your debt. And this is indeed what the central bankers believe. But the other side of that story, if we look farther into it, is that as consumers see falling prices in the things they buy, they can afford to shuttle more money into their debt payments. As you can see, there are two sides of every story, including the deflation-inflation debate. One thing is for sure, however, we have... seen falling prices in many things. The commodity index, which tracks common things like wood, metal, foodstuffs. The commodity index, if you look up the CRB index on your computer, you'll see that it has fallen drastically over the last few years. However, you wouldn't know it by prices in the grocery store. Indeed, prices of things that I buy have gone up, most of the things. Gas prices have gone down. That has seen deflation. Gas prices now in the $2 range, a price we haven't seen in many years. But other things are rising in price, even as the Fed declares deflation is a serious problem. Have you seen things rising in price, or do you think most things are falling? 530-265-9555, 530-265-9555, if you'd like to comment on what you've seen. I'll be glad to take your call intermittently between the show, 530-265-9555. Indeed, many things are rising in price, even as the Fed declares deflation is a serious problem. One of the reasons they don't want to raise rates is because they're afraid of deflation. Central banks are indeed desperately concerned about deflation and have stated such in their periodic announcements and have continued policies to spur inflation. The target here set by the Federal Reserve for inflation is 2% annually. And until that level is reached, they have stated they will continue their programs to arrive at that target, programs being low interest rates and quantitative easing. Considering how much money they have spent on these various programs, like quantitative easing and ultra-low interest rates, which now total into the trillions, one would think that the inflation fires should be raging. But that we don't see massive inflation is perplexing to both the Fed and many analysts. The central banks, however, will not give up on creating inflation, and that means should prices, at least in the metrics they study, continue to fall, more quantitative easing and lower interest rates will be the order of the day. My phone number, 530-265-9555. You can comment on what the prices that you've seen. We'll be right back. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station.
Yeah, I'm the tax man.
and Stevie Ray Vaughan, Double Trouble, the Tax Man. You're listening to the 229th edition of your economic show entitled Money Matters. Your host, Mark Cunaberdi. Thanks for joining me today. And of course, with yesterday, the Federal Reserve continues to push buttons and pull levers to try to control the economy in the direction they want it to go. 7 years after the worst crash since the Depression, here we sit with the markets again, kind of in the doldrums. You wouldn't know it for the last couple of weeks, though. And central banks again looking at their control panels and wondering what to do next. The tools the Federal Reserve and central banks have include low interest rates, quantitative easing, which is purchasing assets from financial institutions. That means they print up money and they buy mortgages or debt from banks. And on occasion, bailout funds and other money creation programs. The common threads include many dynamics. They buy distressed assets from financial institutions, which means if they have toxic mortgages, the banks can't sell. The feds will buy those assets from them. That gives more money to the banks, and that supposedly makes it easier for business and individuals to borrow money. Although the Fed does and can continue to buy distressed assets from the banks until the cows come home and continually help the banks' balance sheets, making money easier to borrow for everyone has its limitations. You can give the banks money, but can they lend it? What the Fed cannot do is force businesses and individuals to take on more debt. You can't force somebody to borrow money, no matter how low rates may go. Therein lies the problem we may be seeing today. Could we be reaching an inflection point where the debt loads in today's societies among individuals and companies are just too large, and people and companies just can't take on any more debt? It's a problem when debt only grows in the upward direction. In 2008 and 2009, debt levels had reached critical levels on many fronts. Banks were knee-deep in debt, and so were many Americans, and indeed many citizens around the world. Instead of allowing the world of debt to bankrupt itself and repudiate that debt or write some of it off, central banks just printed up more money to cover the debt for the financial sectors. Individuals got little relief. We did get cash for clunkers and maybe a $600 check, and some of you got mortgage reductions and various other insignificant debt assistance programs, but the lion's share of individual debt has not been improved upon. Debt levels are still very high and going higher in some instances. Just look at subprime auto debt and auto debt. Look at all the new cars out there. Auto debt is skyrocketing. And at some point, no more debt can be afforded, no matter how low rates may go. This is called pushing on a string. The Fed may be powerless to initiate any improvement in the economy, no matter what it does, because it just can't force you to borrow money. It can improve bank balance sheets, but the lion's share of the real consumer, the real economy, is you, the consumer. Without us, the economy may go nowhere fast. Central banks are toying with a new idea to get people spending, although spending alone, if it encompasses just more debt, could just exacerbate the problems we now face. Central banks, however, seem to be continuing to operate on the notion that any spending is good spending, whether it's debt-fueled or not. Since interest rates are almost as low as they can go, they are talking about negative interest rates, which is to drop interest rates past zero into the negative. This means instead of getting paid to put your money in the bank or getting nothing, the banks actually charge to keep money on deposit. They charge you. You put a dollar in, you get 98 cents back. If saving money costs you money, you might not save it, but spend it. It's an odd way of looking at the old tradition of encouraging savings, which is what your dad used to tell you to do, to just spend all the money you have. Now, what many would call a prudent way of doing things, saving, flies in the face of the idea of negative interest rates. To be clear, Janet Yellen, your Federal Reserve chief, has spoken about negative interest rates, but likely they will only apply to financial institutions at first and not to individuals. Banks and large money centers who currently park money at the Federal Reserve, and they do, these bank and financial centers, park billions and billions of dollars at the Federal Reserve. Right now, the Federal Reserve is paying them interest to do so, which is encouraging them to park money and not lend it out. By implementing negative interest rates, they will charge the banks and financial centers to put money in there. And the thought being that if financial centers can't park money at the Fed, they will lend it out. But the key word here, at least that I have a problem with, is that's just more debt. And if an overabundance of debt is part of the problem in our society, both on the corporation level and the individual level, is making more debt the answer to a healthy economy? Of course, this remains to be seen in whether negative interest rates will actually work. But common sense might lead some to argue against the Fed as to what negative interest rates might accomplish in the long run. Would they lead to a nation higher in debt? And what happens then? Do we just borrow and borrow to the end of time? Is there not an end game to how much debt we can take on? There are indeed many more questions than answers. The Fed can make all the money it wants, and indeed it has made trillions of dollars. But short of sending out free checks to everyone, will people and corporations want to borrow even more if the banks offer more money to lend? With rates already near zero, as I spoke before, we may already have our answer. Can people take on more debt? Only time will tell if the consumer is willing to take on more debt should more money be made available through negative interest rates. But we may already be at the point where no matter how much money is available to borrow, people just can't borrow any more of it. What do you think? 530-265-9555 is the number. You're listening to Money Matters. We'll be right back. So we have an interview here with Alan Greenspan on Bloomberg News. We'll play it for you. Alan's kind of boring, But he does give us some insight. Let's listen up.
Every one of those central banks, whatever their approach, is focused on growth and the problem getting growth going. Do you agree that that is the fundamental problem? And if so, what should be done about it?
It is certainly not the central bank's fundamental problem. The fundamental problem that confronts central banks is to maintain a sound currency. And we've gone far from that, and indeed have required of central banks to do much of what the fiscal system tends to do. And what the cause of the problem that we're dealing with in recent years, the stagnation, is a fiscal problem. It's not a monetary problem. And if you look at the data, what you get struck by is the fact that output per hour, that is productivity growth, on average over the last 5 years, for virtually all of the major countries and a goodly number of the emerging nations, are less than 1%.
So this is a productivity problem at base.
It's a productivity problem that they face, and it is essentially, ultimately, a fiscal problem. They're not all like the United States, but the best way of doing it is to look in terms of what is it that's being produced? Why is there a shortfall in economic activity?
And why is there?
Well, basically because the longer-lived assets, those which are the most risky to invest in, have been very significantly curtailed. Non-residential construction, various long-term assets of all types have been suppressed.
Plants and equipment, things like that.
Plant equipment mainly, yes. But it's even anything with the, real estate with a long life in it gets heavily discounted because the risk of what is going to occur 10, 15, 20 years from now is so high that if you look at what we at the Fed used to call the term structure of interest rates, which is sort of a very good proxy for how earnings are discounted depending on when they're expected to come in, the term premium has risen very sharply so that the gap between, say, the 30-year U.S. Treasury yield and the 5-year Treasury note got to the highest spread in American history, two or three years ago. And it's not come down all that much. And that is basically saying that anything that has a long life to it has got very little present value. And hence, corporate management just does not want to invest in that.
So if that's the problem, what can be done about it?
Well, the fundamental problem, if you dig under the figures, is it is ultimately the fact that entitlements, which are legally required, because that's what they are, they're entitlements, will grow wholly independently of what the ability to fund it is. And the ability to fund it is largely related to the GDP. And I would say it's hard to know exactly, but existing entitlements now probably require a 3-4% growth rate in the United States, for example.
Oh, I'm sorry, just to pay for the entitlements?
No, it requires the context of the types of revenues that arise for government, specifically one form or another, to fund entitlements. Implicit in where the entitlements are on the spending side is an economic growth probably of close to 4%. We're at 2 and struggling at 2. And therefore, what is happening is there has been a significant decline in savings in the society. That is, gross domestic savings as a percent of GDP has been declining over the years, largely because entitlements have dug into them. And in fact, one way to see that is that the sum of entitlement spending plus gross domestic savings, which incidentally is household and business savings, the sum of those two items is, as a percent of GDP, has been relatively constant since 1965. And what that says is, for every dollar increase in entitlements, we've lost a dollar in gross domestic savings, but gross domestic savings causes gross domestic investment, and gross domestic investment is the key element in productivity growth. And so this sequence of starting with an unfundable retirements has led to a stagnation in productivity growth.
So to oversimplify, instead of investing in things like plants and equipment, long-term capital assets, we're spending it on entitlements. Those dollars are going for entitlements.
That's exactly the issue. The interesting thing about it is that during Republican administrations, entitlements grew more than on average during Democratic administrations.
And that is your party, after all.
It is my party. I want you to observe how much this issue is being discussed in this campaign. This is what they should be talking about. The problem is that entitlements is the third rail of American politics. You touch it and you lose.
Right.
Alan Greenspan, we have a caller live on the air. Good afternoon,
hey,
caller.
Mark.
How are you?
Oh, good. Mark, thanks for your show. I got to turn the radio off, sorry. Your point that maybe we've reached the saturation of debt, people don't want to add on more debt, carry more debt, and this Alan Greenspan's point about productivity growth not continuing. China has all kinds of productivity growth and cheaper products, which we are buying more and more of. And that really can't change things if people don't want to buy or load up more on debt or don't have the jobs to provide the income to continue to be consumers, radical consumers, which I think in the last 20 or 30 years we were, and that's changed. So I agree. We're saturated with debt, and I'd like you to explore how recessions level off values to be more reasonable, and then maybe people would borrow money and invest in something that's undervalued. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your phone call. We're just about running out of time here. We can take one more call. You're live on the air.
Oh, good afternoon, Mark. Am I on right now?
Yeah, you are. Just make sure you turn your radio down in the background there.
I was listening to the previous caller.
You got
to
be quick.
My question is this, Mark. SolarCity's down 58% and just dropped another couple percent. Another installation company is down as well. With Saudi Arabia pumping oil at such low prices, a lot of people thought they wanted the small marketers, the small oil producers around the world just to sort of pack up and go home to get more market share. And I'm kind of thinking they want to do more than that. They want to just, it's going to be solar or you know, wind or something against petroleum eventually. Is that the long-term view, you think, that they're just want to keep the prices low so that along with the fading away tax incentives for people to put solar on their house seems to be pushing solar out of the range of competition.
You know, it's very funny. Anytime a man seems to find a better way to do things cheaper, the government finds a way to tax it. I was rather disappointed in them starting to tax solar. I know that. I'm sure you were
as
well.
Yeah, I was.
All right, I'm going to answer the rest of your call off the air because...
Thanks very much, Mark.
Okay, great.
Okay, I'll listen to you.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
And so, I think the many believe that the Saudis would not curtail their oil production and to let oil prices drop to put the United States oil sands business out of business and the fracking out of business. But once you let the cat out of the bag and you started dropping oil prices, oil companies started to produce more oil so they could save their balance sheets. You know, when you need to pay off your debts, you need to produce more if you're not making as much, and then the thing just sort of spiraled downward. And I don't know how long the Saudis can tolerate this low of an oil price. It sure drove a stake through our oil industry, at least for the companies that produce it. For the consumer, obviously, it was a good thing. But so the Saudi Arabia definitely started it rolling, and now they got to live with it, and we're going to see what happens from there. Okay, this has been show number 229 of Money Matters, and my name's Mark Cunaberti. You can contact the program director at your station for questions about the show, and see the program schedule on your community radio station for all the fine programming that you might see on community radio stations such as we have here. And I'd like to remind you once again that discussions on this radio show should not be construed as individual investment advice. Please consult a qualified investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed on this show, of course, are my opinions only and of my guests and phone callers. They may not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. My name is Mark Cunaberti. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Feel free to contact me with any questions, and have a great day.